to the recipients of the grants as well. I'm particularly interested in the work that a lot of you do with young people, because I think it's the most important thing. When I was growing up, I came, my family moved to Wisconsin, a small town called Janesville, which is the home of the Parker Pen and was a big Chevrolet plant once upon a time. My father was a comptroller in various Chevrolet situations, and we moved every 4 years. The school that I attended when I was just barely 8 years old was staffed by a very interesting order of German ladies, nuns, who immediately put me to the piano and to the organ at the same time, and started me on the simplest pieces of Bach. So that was the first thing. And I couldn't really reach the pedals yet. I was eight. You never saw legs grow so fast in 1 year as the desire I had to play the organ and so forth. So I had that chance. Then we moved 4 years later to Detroit, and I was 11 or 12, and I had my first church job. I auditioned for the position that was open, and I had a children's choir, a men's choir, and a mixed adult choir, and I played all the services, the funerals, the weddings, all those kind of things. I was something of a celebrity because I could be late for school and if I had a funeral to play and all that kind of thing. But it was an enormous sort of self-awareness experience. And I became very, very centered on music at that moment. And when I went, the next move was to California, and I was 16. And I auditioned for a group called the Oakland Civic Light Opera Association. The Oakland Civic Light Opera still exists. It was conducted then by a real gnarly old man of the theater named John Falls. And he said to me I was too young to audition for the Oakland Civic Light Opera, but he would let me do it anyway to give me experience. He took me, in spite of saying that I was too young, into the chorus, and there I was in the front because I was a little guy, dancing and singing in all the productions like Oklahoma and New Moon and all the rest of it. But more importantly, he said to me at one point when we were rehearsing New Moon in the very first season, which would have been, I think, 1956, he said, listen, he said, I'm not feeling particularly well today. Would you mind taking this rehearsal? And so I did. And, you know, 16-year-olds are not usually very afraid of anything. They just get up and do it and so forth. Well, then he told me afterwards, well, I would have done that, and I might have done that a different way or something like that. And he essentially gave me my first real chance as a conductor. There was a singer then, Jess Thomas, who became a very famous Wagnerian singer. And he was transitioning from baritone to tenor, and in the lead in New Moon, it was his first tenor role. And he was giving a recital at something like, some Rotary Club or something like that. And he was giving a recital. And he didn't have a pianist that could play his songs, I don't remember what they were, but they were classical songs, in higher keys than the printed version, and some of them in between keys. Well, I could, because my voice changed, and I had to learn to play the music that I was singing in church in a different key, because I could no longer sing the Mass of the Angels in E-flat. I had to transpose it down to C, and I tricked myself by simply saying, that's easy. These lines of the ledger lines of the staff will remain the same in my mind. I'll just eliminate the flats and read it a third differently in C. So that was an easy trick. Harder was to transpose from E flat to D flat or up or something like that. That took me longer to figure out. In any case, that was the great moment of the Oakland Civic Light Opera Association. I also had in California my own group for the first time, the first incarnation, you might say, of the John Oliver Chorale. And I did the same thing when I went to Notre Dame. I formed my own group. nobody was ever happy about it because they felt it competed with the groups, the other groups. But I just had to, I couldn't get enough of it, music. Then I came, of course, to Boston. I spent the first 2 years on the beach, I think, as much as I could, and didn't go to graduate school right away. I supported myself by playing in the clubs and also by having a church job, the most important of which was Sacred Heart Church in Roslindale. Monsignor Edward Murray was the pastor there, and he was a trustee of the Boston Symphony. And that was the group that, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. I then went in the third year I was here and auditioned for Laura Cook de Baron and studied with her at the New England Conservatory to get my master's degree. And I studied also with Gladys Miller, one of my greatest, greatest influences in every way. I was sitting in Laura's office one day, in the choral office at the New England Conservatory, and the phone rang, and it was Mary Smith, an executive with the Boston Symphony. And she said, and she was practically hysterical, she said, "Does anybody have a boy choir? We're doing excerpts from Vossek next week, and no one told me there was a boy choir." Of course, I was still not very afraid of much. I was 24. And I said, "Sure." And I showed up with my boy choir, who probably didn't come in the first time in the right place. You know, this is the way things go. But it was successful enough that they asked me to form an all-Boston boy choir. And I remember Andrew Raper and I going around all the parishes in Boston and auditioning boys for this Boston boy choir. And we recorded the Mahler Third in 1966 with that. In 1968, I got a call from Mary, or I think it was 67, could I come for the summer in 68 and 69 to Tanglewood and be Eric Klein's first assistant in choral and vocal activities? Sure, I could, and did. And then when Weinstorff was leaving, Mary Smith and Harry Prout, who went on to be Leonard Bernstein's personal manager for many years, called me in the office and said, "Would you take over choral and vocal activities at Tanglewood?" And I said, "Of course, I would be honored to do that, but I think we need to have a chorus," because there was no official chorus for the Boston Symphony at the time. Things were fine when Chorus per Musica sang, not so fine when the school groups sang, because it's very hard to have consistency with school choruses in language and in musical skills, of course. And then, of course, in the summer, it was just a throw together whoever you can get to come there for the summer. When I was there in 63 and 64, there was a choral program. But in 68 and 69, when I was there, most of the singers that sang in the chorus at Tanglewood were people from the New York City Opera who sang in the chorus at the New York City Opera and were out of work for the summer. So they had nothing else to do, and Charlie Wilson knew them, and Linesworth, of course, was big at the City Opera, so that's what they did for the summer. So it was kind of a throw-together kind of thing. And I said, "You really need something that will be consistent all the time." And I fought for the name. They didn't want to give me the name, Tanglewood Festival Chorus. They didn't want to give away the name. I didn't want Boston Symphony Orchestra Chorus because I didn't want someday to read the Boston Symphony Orchestra and Chorus. I wanted it to have a distinct name. They wanted to have a name that connected it with BU. I think they were afraid maybe a little bit of the unionization business at that time. This was 1969-70. But I fought for the name, and I got the name. They gave in, and I got the name. First year was a trial and error. There were only 60 people in the chorus, and we did the first weekend with Chorus per Musica. I knew Bud already because he had been on the faculty at Tanglewood when I was there in 63 and 64. The second program was combined with Harvard Radcliffe, and the third program, which was the Berlioz Requiem, was a combination of the new 60 voices of the Tanglewood Festival Chorus and the members of the Framingham Choral Society, who happened to have me as a conductor. So that's when I was really on the spot, because my work was represented completely there. And they came to the first rehearsal at Tanglewood, I think it was probably a Wednesday night, and it was about 110 degrees, and it was pouring with rain, And they sank flat for 2.5, 3 hours. And I thought to myself, maybe I should have taken those architecture courses more seriously and not gotten out of trigonometry and math and all that stuff. But in any case, they got a good night's sleep and got up the next morning, and they were fine. They were on pitch. And that was it. We were off and running. And it's been a wonderful journey. I was 20 years the head of the vocal program, and then it was time to move on. And by that time, the whole vocal world had changed so much. When I started it, there were hardly any real professionals in the coaching area. I mean, there were some, but not a whole lot. But by the time I finished in 1990, every university across the country had extensive vocal training and vocal coaching and language coaching and things like that, diction courses, of course, which hardly existed when I started. So that all changed. And of course, I went on with MIT and with the chorale and did quite a number of guests conducting things, not a whole lot. I'm going in December to conduct the Montreal Symphony of Messiah, and that will be a lot of fun. It's a piece I haven't done very much, interestingly enough. And the first performance I did that I ever did myself of it was in Sanders Theater, and the soloists were Cheryl Studer, Jeffrey Gall, Randy Outland, and David Dietz. And it was a phenomenal performance. And of course, we did it it was before the early music movement, but we still did it in a very pared down, slim kind of way. Although I have to confess that we decorated it more in the style of Joan Sutherland than the true Bach style. But we did have a very good time. And Cheryl Studer was really something when she was 20 years old, let me tell you. But that's the way it's been. Now, I just observed to Fosse, whom I've known all these years, that when I founded the Tanglewood Chorus, all voice teachers told their students, don't sing in that chorus, you'll wreck your voice. And there was absolutely the way it was in 1970. Now, the chorus is full of graduate students and undergraduate voice majors from all the conservatories in the town. And Bill Cutter told me, who I worked with for so many years, he told me recently he heard a conversation in the hall at Boston Conservatory of some kids excited and saying to some other kids, you've got to join our chorus. They memorize everything. And I thought that really was a long way around from the early years when it was sometimes like pulling teeth to get the intonation correct, to get the language correct, and all that kind of thing. But of course, we did have 42 years to work on it, so there we were. And in fact, when they discussed, when they proposed this award to me, I said, but it's not over yet. So forth. I'm very, very honored. Congratulations for the work you do. It's very important. And we often say to ourselves, after a Tanglewood Festival chorus rehearsal, and it's true of all of your choruses, that the diversity in the room is so extreme that you're sure that not a whole lot of those people would be friends outside the room. And yet, in the context of making music, everything comes together. And I think in our troubled world today, that's very important.
Who, by creating and conducting extraordinary vocal ensembles, has enabled audiences to experience the transformative power of great choral music superbly performed. And we had a retreat, Choral Arts New England this summer had a retreat during which we discussed at a very high level what it is that makes choral music, excellent choral music, excellent. And it was that very transformative.
Yes.
There's a transcendence that happens yes. when you are in a great ensemble. And once you experience it, you're hooked for life.
Yes.
And I think this man has hooked more people than just about anybody else.
Well, it's very interesting because there are 280 people on the roster, give or take. And the fact that they memorize everything was a bone of contention at the beginning. Please sit. It was a bone of contention at the beginning because there were people that said we didn't want to invest that much in it. And of course, the first thing that was memorized was Tosca because the lights were out. And the next year, Jean d'Arc au Guichet, you know, the same thing, the lights were out. So you can't hold music when the lights are out. And I said that there's only a short distance to memorize the Ninth Symphony, which you sing every year, and some of the other pieces that regularly come up in the repertoire. And eventually it evolved into what it is today, and they take enormous pride in it. It is really extraordinary. And they come usually pretty much off book to the first rehearsal, which tells you something that has evolved over the years, you know. And there's an ownership about that kind of study, where they prepare the music themselves before they even get to the first rehearsal. Then they don't feel like someone else has ground it into them at all.